Thanks very much for your introduction, Brendan, and I acknowledge Mary Porter of the Legislative Assembly too. I honour the traditional owners of this land, and I acknowledge all those people who work for the lifting of the oppression of disability, disease and poverty, and particularly mental health. I'm not a criminologist, and as you've heard, I've spent a lot of time working as a doctor, not all my time, but some of my time, amongst homeless people. So some of my perspectives will come from that in looking at this issue. The other thing is that in New South Wales, I'm part of a group which is trying to understand what happens to people, a bit the way Mr. Smith was describing, after they leave prison. And it's a very complex project, and I don't pretend that I'm master of it at all, but it's going to look at how, when a person leaves prison, they interact with the health system, how they interact with the drug and alcohol services, how they interact with the Department of Community Services, how they interact with the police. And the first thing to say about that is that each of those groups has different objectives for the person. And so they all collect different data about the person. And that in itself is an important idea for exploration, that all these systems construct a different view of that person, their characteristics and what their future might be. 30 years ago, which is about the time that I started working in the environment of the homeless in Sydney, I would often ask myself, what had cast that person to be there in front of me? What throw of the dice had determined that he was there, sitting in front of me, or that he may have been in prison? And I'm talking about he, because we probably dealt with men in that environment, or an asylum. And there were lots of asylums there in those days, and we had lots of public discussion about the asylums. Now, that dice is still cast now, but the outcomes are different. There are fewer places for the mentally ill, and I'm certainly not arguing for more institutional care of the mentally ill. There are less places for the homeless, and there are more places in prisons. And it really is hard to understand that the Western liberal democracies are putting greater numbers of people in prison. And the United States does this at an alarming rate. Their imprisonment rate is 4 to 5 times that of the Australian population. I've just recognised Michael Levy up the back. Greetings, Michael. Michael used to be one of my students, and he worked in the Corrections Health Services in New South Wales. And the rates of imprisonment in that country are of the order of 726 per 100,000. The Australian imprisonment rate is about 162 per 100,000. The Guardian Weekly, quite recently, in an article about poverty and race, speaking about the United States, had this to say about the US ghettos. Yet a vast underclass inhabits the ghettos, mired in joblessness, drugs and gang violence. And in the inner cities, half of all the black males do not finish high school, and 6 in 10 of those will end up in jail by the time they're 30. This is an environment more segregated, hopeless and dangerous than the Jim Crow era of the Deep South. And I remember listening to an ABC broadcast recently where a planner in the United States was saying that they use the education rates in states to predict what the amount of prison places they would have to create. The Australian rates of imprisonment are increasing. In the 10 years from 1993, there was a 23% increase in the prison population, and those increases were highest in the Northern Territory and South Australia. Midway through last year, there were 27,224 prisoners in Australian prisons, which was a 6% increase on the previous year. Now, in our community, and governments are attempting at both national and local levels to develop programs to prevent crime, to prevent suicide, to prevent mental illness, to prevent drug and alcohol problems. And at a Commonwealth level, there are formal crime prevention strategies. There's a national mental health strategy. There's a national suicide strategy. And there's a national drug strategy. And if you read those documents, as I've done, because I've been involved in chairing the suicide prevention strategy, you will see that the first five chapters are almost identical. They talk about the same risk factors. They talk about the same protective factors that are important to prevent those outcomes that I've been describing. Each of them stresses the importance of a family, of nurturing, of safety, of education and social support, community capacity, and the material and physical resources for a family to survive, and above all, for young people to reach their potential. Now, the point about that is that there are common pathways which lead to a cluster of outcomes in adolescence and adult life, and they are quite unpredictable. It's hard to know where a person who goes along that pathway, a young person along that pathway, will end up with a problem in one of those areas or defined in that particular way. So here too is another throw of the dice. The dice being cast in terms of exposure to risks and how well we protect young people during their periods of development and nurture them. And as I've implied, that dice in that pathway determines whether people get mental disorders, risks of suicide, substance abuse problems, antisocial behaviour, or even educational outcomes, or a combination of all those. So that really is the real challenge for prevention. And fortunately in Australia, there are some terrific people who are leading the thinking about how we've got to contribute to the early developments of childhood and the support of families. But it does raise a whole set of questions about, you know, what we think is important, what's important about communities, what's important about relationships, what's the nature of education, and so on. Who then gets in prison? Well, as I've indicated, in the United States, a disproportionate number of Afro-Americans are imprisoned. And in Australian prisons, Indigenous people are overrepresented at an order of magnitude very much greater than the non-Indigenous population. And you've only got to recall the Commission of Inquiry into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, which was a benchmark of that sad state of affairs. But what we're concerned about today is the disproportionate number of people in prison who've got serious impairments of their minds and their bodies. And before I make comments about this, I acknowledge Dr. Michael Levy up the back, I want to acknowledge that the health service, the Justice Health Service in New South Wales, has got very good people working in it. And if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have a lot of the data and understanding that we have now about the extent of mental health and physical illness in those in the justice systems. And in fact, some of the, I would say, internationally best research that's been done in this environment has been done in New South Wales prisons by some of my colleagues who've looked at, for example, hepatitis C, injecting drug practices, and indeed the introduction of drug and alcohol treatment programs. Nevertheless, it's a big task, and a lot more even in that environment, and very much in that environment, has to be done. So the current estimates are that 40% of male prisoners and 60% of female prisoners have a mental health disorder or a cognitive disability. So we mustn't forget that quite a lot of the people who end up in prisons have difficulty with planning and thinking and intellectual development. And a study done in the year 2003, and Michael Levy might have contributed to this, showed that there was a 12-month prevalence of any psychiatric disorder by which is meant psychosis, anxiety disorder, affective disorder, personality disorder, or neurasthenia. I thought we'd lost that classification, but it was used. In the New South Wales prison was 74%, compared with 22% in the general population. Half of the inmates in reception and over one third of those who were sentenced had a severe mental disorder at the time, psychosis, affective disorder, or an anxiety disorder. And in the 12 months prior to that, two out of three of them have had a diagnosis of substance use disorder. And that, those terms, substance use disorder, have a special meaning. They're a level of substance use of special significance, which mean that the person has a significant degree of impairment or functional problems in relation to their substance use. And in the 12 months prior to their admission to prison, 1 in 20 had attempted suicide. And I'm not going to give you the figures here, but the extraordinary thing is amongst the female prisoners, the sorts of things I've been describing to you then are of an order of magnitude greater amongst the women in prison. And it makes you ask the question, why on earth are they in prison? If anything, the picture suggests that they're more the victims rather than the perpetrators of antisocial behaviour. Now, with other hats on, I've been involved in drug and alcohol treatment programs in New South Wales, and very often the women in the methadone programs have been in prison, and of course they've got dependent children. And as you interview them, see them, you can see that in the way their lives have developed and the sorts of families and backgrounds that they have come from, that they've been dealt a very rough deal indeed, often cowed by their relationships and circumstances. In 1988 in Sydney, a remarkable group of people, that was about the same time that Australia for the first time had done a national survey of mental health, and there were instruments which had been developed which had been applied to the whole population. And we learned for the first time, although most of the agencies would say this, that 1 in 20 Australians had a significant mental disorder during the previous year. So that was a national survey, the first time we've ever done it. It's now, I think, about to be repeated. But the group that designed that also decided that they would apply the same screening questionnaires to homeless populations in Sydney, to the inner Sydney, inner Sydney homeless. And they summarised their findings in this way. Homeless people are clearly one of the most deprived groups in the community. Three out of four had a mental disorder. Co-occurring disorders, and I would assume most of you know what we mean by that, but that's a concurrent mental health disorder with a substance use problem. And almost all had experienced at least one episode of extreme trauma in their life. And on most measures of morbidity, the young are as at least impaired as the older person. They found that 23% of the men in the homeless scene had a formal diagnosis of schizophrenia. It was double that in women who are homeless, 46%. 49% of the men had an alcohol use disorder, 15% of the women. 36% had a drug use disorder, 33% had a mood disorder, 26% an anxiety disorder, and 10% had cognitive impairment, in other words, some form of brain impairment. 93% of them reported at least one episode of extreme trauma in their lives, and for women that was 100%. One in two women had been raped, and one in 10 men reported that they had been raped. Every second person had at least one chronic physical illness, and 9% had reported hepatitis B or C. One of the things that happens in people whose social predicament becomes the way we're discussing it, being imprisoned or homeless or mentally ill, is they commonly don't have one single problem. They have a fistful of problems. And in the homeless scene, there wouldn't be one of those people who didn't have a very substantial physical illness at the same time. Indeed, in this particular survey, half of them had a physical illness. In New York a few years ago, there was a street clinic looking at homeless people. Again, you know, New York and these other cities, it's often the mentally ill people that are homeless wandering the streets. This street clinic, very familiar to the sort of environment to the one I've been thinking of, where people get feet problems and have to have their feet bathed in Condi's crystals and bandages stuck on and all sorts of things. But in the survey of those people who were in the street in New York, they had 9 diagnosable medical conditions at any one time on average. So these are people who've got a fistful of problems. And in a way, the way we divide up our medical and service responses under diagnostic groupings, mental illness versus substance use versus diabetes, commonly complicates the picture. However, I've talked a bit about the homeless because I know them in great detail, but when I saw the figures that came out of the studies that colleagues and others did in the prisons in New South Wales, it was almost as if the same template had been used. The patterns were similar, perhaps not as intense, because people in jail tend to be a younger age group than the ones that are homeless. Although that too is a bit of a myth, because when you see homeless people, a 50-year-old man actually looks about 75. A 30-year-old man looks about 50. You know, time, exposure, diseases, weather, people. So our concern today is with mental illness, with cognitive impairments, substance use, and how they clump together in imprisonment. And of course, imprisonment is totally inappropriate for a mentally ill person where the aim is to normalise that person's life and relationship. And one accepts that there are some people who need to be contained because of their behaviour, and that's the only thing you can do. But the aim with managing people with mental illnesses, if you look at the Mental Health Acts of this territory and other states, are to provide care and opportunities for people in the least restrictive environments. And that then raises questions about how we manage our prisons. In a similar vein, in a person that has developed an addiction, and you want to re-establish that person back with normal life goals and relationships, prison is not the way where you're going to really establish that. In fact, there's a bit of a parallel to experience of working in a public hospital. You'll find that someone has come in with people concerned that they might be addicted to morphine or something of that kind. And the doctors and nurses will say, oh, look, we've got to fix their addiction right now. But you can't fix an addiction unless the person is really living in the community, because it's about their relationships, their orientation, their connections, and the way they are shaping their lives that become important in trying to rehabilitate someone back into normal life who's been addicted. Of course, sanctions are necessary for bad behaviour, but we need those sanctions to be applied carefully, justly, and primarily with the aim that we ought to be trying to re-establish that person back into productive life, and in particular with their families. In New South Wales, I'm not sure whether it's opened yet, but there's a prison being built, which is for people who've got drug problems, and the idea is that they will have forced management of their drug problems, because the drug problem has become the principal mechanism of their offending behaviour. And being a doctor, I felt that was inappropriate and a wrong thing to do. However, I must say that seeing the way the leader of that prison is managing that prison, I've come to think that some good can come out of that, because there's been much more effort being put into the real rehabilitation processes, which I don't fully understand, but incentives and rewards and encouragement. Yes, there'll be sanctions. They've even got a dental chair in it, and specialised areas for these people. So a lot of effort's been put into that, what I thought was a wrong thing to do, to get a rehabilitation program with a really good structure around it. And what's more, I think the initial idea was, you know, we'd put these people away for 3 years. But it's not going to be like that at all. It's going to be a very staged, very planned, organised response of a period of containment, but an enormous amount of effort being put into reconnecting that person back into the community. So my misgivings about that form of coercion have been tempered in that environment to see the leadership and the commitment of the people that are going to run it. Now, your report canvasses many issues that need to be addressed if the ACT prison is to deal with humanely with those who have impaired minds and bodies. And I've just extracted some principles from it. The prison regime should be conducive to mental health. That's a sensible principle and goal. It should have the capacity to screen, diagnose, and recognise those who are at mental health risk. It should have high access to high quality health care, and particularly mental health care. It should have drug and alcohol programs, including access to pharmacotherapy treatment. There should be capacities for family contact, support, and particularly support of the family outside without their relative being with them. There should be a strong commitment to rehabilitation from all of the things we've been talking about, crime, mental illness and substance use disorders. And there should be a well-structured follow-up program. I call it the chain of care. Nothing in the health system, in the area of addiction, mental health, and particularly prison effectiveness, works. Suicide prevention works unless you have this idea that we've done our job at this point in time, but that won't work unless we've established a link to the next chain in the process. I went to Norway a few years ago to do a suicide prevention, and he said, a man who was quite a leader there, he said, Ian, we've got these public metaphors in this country, the way we speak about things, and one of the public metaphors is the chain of care that we get, that nothing will work effectively in this area of suicide prevention unless we've established a responsibility to make that next connection work. So I stress that particularly, and it's one of our major failings of all our human service systems. Certainly the medical system, which I work in, is not particularly good at that. So I commend the ACT Coalition and their report, which aims to improve the outcomes for those with mental illness and substance use disorders who may become imprisoned there. And I hope the Coalition will work cooperatively, as Mr. Smith has said, too, with the ACT government and the correction staff, their health and welfare staff, with the aim of ensuring that mental health is maintained and that there are good and strong programs to re-establish offenders with their families and communities on discharge. A really key period, which I've tried to emphasise, is the immediate period after discharge. There have been studies in New South Wales and across the world which showed the rates of return to drug use are extraordinarily high in that immediate post-discharge period. It's also the period of high risk from suicide, and it's also a high period of death rates in prisoners. So that follow-through and support during that period is especially important. So it's with great pleasure that I've got a copy of the report that from outside the ACT, that's admiring what people are doing, particularly the groups who coalesce around these issues, to review the important people in our communities. I have great pleasure in launching the report, Healthy or Harmful, from the ACT Community Coalition on Corrections, entitled Mental Health and the Operational Regime of the New ACT Prison. And I know some of you have done an enormous amount of work on that, and thanks for doing it. Thank you.